A lot of people want to be a rock star.
Yeah.
What does it feel to be a rock star and have you look out and there's thousands of people and they know every lyric and they're moving to your music? What does that feel like?
Well, it's a bit like, you know, a seven-year-old jumping on the table and a family get-together and showing off, you know, but it's on a bigger scale. But actually, I'm a real mixture between a sort of show-off extrovert and a very shy person. But when you feel the engagement and you feel the warmth of the people, it's like nothing else. It's an amazing and experience, great privilege.
The feeling is mutual, Peter Gabriel. Speaking on behalf of rock fans, if I may, I saw Peter Gabriel in concert in 1988, and it was an amazing experience and a great privilege. Gabriel was at the peak of his fame then. He'd recently had huge hits off his album So, including this one. The video for Sledgehammer, by the way, still holds the record for the number of MTV Video Awards, 9. You could have a steam train. Of course, Peter Gabriel had been one of the biggest stars of the 1970s, too, as frontman for the rock band Genesis. But much of his career has also been dedicated to the cause of human rights and to bringing hundreds of musicians from around the world to international attention through a festival, a studio, and a record label he created. So we've got music, politics, and much more from Peter Gabriel on this episode of What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler.
Adame, this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
Peter Gabriel is 69 now. When he took the stage at the Academy of Achievement Summit in London in 2017, he didn't look anything like his former rocker self. No batwing costume or fluorescent makeup from his Genesis days. No white flappy jacket or gelled hair from the 80s. In fact, not much hair at all. Just a fringe of white, a goatee, and glasses. But still those piercing blue eyes, and still that sandy, warm voice, which captivated all the scholars and honorees gathered when he was asked to give an impromptu speech.
I started off spectacular candidate for the Academy of Non-Achievement. My parents were quite worried. I was failing most of my exams at school, and but I had found something that I truly loved. When we were taken away on holiday and there was a band playing, I used to watch the drummer, and whenever my parents would want to go off to bed, I would just sit there hypnotized, thinking, I want to hit things and make a loud noise. And I was sent to a very formal, traditional English school. And music was a place, you know, we had a basement where with a record player. And I could turn it up loud, and I could feel things, and I could dance around and feel like a free man. And it was a sort of wonderful release. And then I got interested in actually trying to put songs together. And it was, a songwriter was really the goal for me then, with the bands that I could occupy myself with as a drummer, not a very good drummer, really enthusiastic, but just not very talented. But I managed to find my way into a jazz band and into a rock band and a blues band. And so anyone that would have me, I'd be delighted. And we started dreaming of songwriting. I'm going to divert here because I'm improvising to a story that I liked about another songwriter who was determined to get Elvis Presley to sing one of his songs. So he saw that he tried Carlin Music, were a controlling music publisher, and they controlled everything that Elvis ever recorded. And this guy was absolutely obsessed with a single idea of getting a song of his recorded by Elvis. So he heard he was going to play in Las Vegas again and come out of retirement. So he sat in the toilet where he thought Elvis would go when, as a human being, he needed to do his normal things, and waited and waited and waited. And in the end, the great man came to do his business in the cabin next to him. And he summoned up enormous courage and asked if he could give him a song. And so Elvis said, "Well, if it's any good, I'll know. Just sing it to me." And so from one cabin to another, in the ghetto, was sung. And it was the only sort of social commentary song that Elvis ever recorded. But I think, you know, part of the reason we're here is to say how we got away with doing what we do, and encourage you really to take those crazy chances. And I know there are plenty of voices that are going to tell you, "You're crap, you can't do this, it's not going to work." Don't be one of those voices. You've got to be the voice that says, "Okay, maybe it might work. Maybe I just can do that."
One of the first obstacles Peter Gabriel had to overcome on his way to stardom was the disapproval of that fancy boarding school, where he and his classmates formed Genesis. The past is clear, though no eyes can see. The course laid down long before. And so with gods and men, the sheep remain inside their pen, though many times they've seen the way to leave. He talked about the band's somewhat subversive beginnings during his interview with Mary Jordan for the Academy of Achievement in 2018.
There was a lot of discussion about whether we should continue with music. I mean, you know, though the school now would be very proud of Genesis and our history, they weren't really supportive. They sort of tolerated a rock group. And, you know, I remember Mike Rutherford was told, you know, not to carry on playing and mixing with disreputable types. And so this was something that, for us, was really important because it was not quite Tom Brown's school days, but it was a formal English school with discipline and not a lot of compassion. And the tighter the discipline, the more human nature wants to rebel against it. So music was our way. And there was a film Lindsay Anderson did called If, which sort of captured, I think, the emotion of the experience.
Stand up properly when the head of house addresses you. There's something indecent about you, Travis. The way you slouch about. You think we don't notice you with your hands in your pockets. The way you just sit there looking at everyone.
You three have become a danger to the morale of the whole house.
You can take that cheap little grin off your mouth.
The movie If is an icon of British counterculture, and it actually came out the very year Genesis put out their first album, 1968. They produced it during their summer break from school and called the album From Genesis to Revelation. But the joke was lost on record stores that placed it in the religious music bins. It would take a few more years for Genesis to break through. Over the garden wall, two little lovebirds, cuckoo to you. Keep
Did you see yourself as a songwriter or a singer?
I saw myself as a drummer first and songwriter. Yeah, we were planning to be songwriters. We didn't really want to be a group. The harsh reality of dreams of writing hits is that no one is interested in recording them. So we had to start playing them ourselves. And then that evolved and we wanted to explore different types of music. You know, it was the beginning of the 60s and merging different styles seemed to us to be exciting and revolutionary, and so that's what we were trying to do.
They were called folk blues mystical or progressive rock, and sometimes art house rock.
Did anyone influence you in songwriting or music?
So many people. You know, I think you instinctively absorb from whatever you're hearing, you know, and which is why my 10-year-old is a DJ on the way to school, so if my next record sounds like Justin Bieber, you know why. But it was R&B, blues, soul, and the beat boom. You know, the Beatles were, I was 13 in 1963 when I heard Love Me Do on the radio on the back of my parents' car. And people don't think of the Beatles as sort of rough and revolutionary, but at that time, it was all sort of Shirley Bassey and sweet-sounding songs. And this rough, tough band sound in Love Me Do was very, very different.
How did it go?
Love, Love Me Do. Yeah. So Please, Please Me was what the first record I bought with my pocket money. But Otis Redding was the king for me. And I was lucky enough at 17 to go down to the Ram Jam Club in Brixton here. And there were maybe three white faces there. It was the best gig of my life still to this day.
Well,
it was like the sun coming out. It was just this warmth. And then this amazing voice, band, generosity. You know, I mean, Springsteen gives a ton when he performs, but Otis pips him, in my opinion. So it was just something else. I mean, I guess I was right. You know, I think what hits us hard when we're 17 stays with us for life. And that was it for me.
Let's go back to costumes, which
yeah.
were fantastic. Those costumes you came out were stunning. What was the idea behind that?
Some of them were pretty tacky too, but it's the idea was to get rich and famous. You know, it was we were in a group that was sort of disappearing into the oblivion. I mean, that was one side of it, but there was another side which was an evolution. We loved the sound of 12-string guitars. Now, this was old days, so it meant there weren't electronic tuners. You know, three guys with 36 strings at their command would sit there twiddling knobs and until they got the guitars in tune. So there were long pauses between each song. And if you're in a small club and there's an audience and a bunch of musicians, you know, you've just got something going and then they're sitting there and all the energy has been dissipated. They look to the mug behind the microphone to do something. So I started telling stories. And so partly there were characters coming out in these stories and emerging. And we had on one album character with Paul Whitehead had created with a fox head and a red dress. And I sat around with Paul Conroy, who was working in our record company at the time. He was saying, well, why don't we get someone to walk around the gig in the fox head and the red dress? And I thought, oh, I might as well give that a go. So I went into my wife's wardrobe and pulled out a red dress, which at that point I was thin enough to get into it, and we got this sort of fox head made up. And I remember the first gig that I wore it was in this former bullring in Dublin, which was not exactly the most sort of enlightened transgender environment. There was a shock. Literally, you could hear a pin drop when I walked out in this costume, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. Get him out by Friday. And the band, of course, didn't really know that I was going to do this. I'd mentioned something with Foxhead, but I didn't discuss it because I knew there would not be a majority vote going my way. And the same, you know, when I came up with a whole lot more costumes at the Rainbow.
But the fans loved it.
Well, and the following day we got on the front page of Melody Maker, and suddenly, you know, from £50 a week per head, we were on 150. So, you know, life was looking up. So there were practical advantages to the costumes. But it was actually a lot of fun. And sometimes, you know, when you come out and this weird keyboard sound and there's dry ice and I'm wearing this sort of UV makeup and bat wings, it was like a sci-fi moment, and you took people to some other place. And I think the musicians in the band were both appalled and delighted.
Did other people start copying you then? Because there were quite a lot of people that started doing kind of outlandish, kind of wild things. Costumes.
Well, I know Neil Bogart said he persuaded this group called Kiss to start wearing stuff, but their story is very different from that. So. I don't know. But there were, you know, Bowie was always in weird dress, so he was there ahead of us. I mean, we did one concert with him in the Roundhouse here, and it was with the Living Theatre, and it was one of these hippie festival things. There were probably 40 people on stage, probably 22 in the audience. It was a miserable event, but... But it was interesting, and that was my first encounter with Bowie.
Genesis was so successful, so young, but then you were only 25 years old and you walked away. Why? Why start on your own?
You know, I'm quite fond of them all to this day, but it's band politics is just classic, and, you know, got to the point where to get something done, you'd have to persuade... Tony and I, we were often best friends, worst enemies. I would sometimes try and persuade him that what I wanted was his idea. And he was always very protective of the keyboard. He didn't want anyone else getting near his keyboard. Whereas I wanted to express myself and play with that. But then I think there was a decisive thing when my first daughter, Anna, was born. And they didn't think she would survive, and there was a whole number of things. So my wife, Jill, wasn't allowed to see her then, and she was in an incubator. It was the most traumatic experience of my life at that point, and the band were very unappreciative. Phil had a child then, but on the whole, We were trying to get the Lamb Lies Down on Broadway recorded at that time, and that was in far west Wales, and the drive was pretty hellish getting there and back. And there was no question in my mind that family comes first. So I think things got soured at that point.
In certain ways, you could say Peter Gabriel was a reluctant rock star, or at least an ambivalent one, who was never willing to buy into all the trappings. He was never a heavy drinker or drug user, for example, and for sure, becoming a husband and a father so early in his career and living through that trauma he just described crystallized what was important for him.
In truth, you know, we're a mixture of our higher and lower natures. So there's definitely part of me that wanted attention and girls, and the other part of me, you know, just loved music and wanted to follow my heart. So I think the truth is always somewhere in, but, you know, it's composite. And I always thought of myself as a weekend rock star. You know, it was a fun place to get your ego stroked, but toxic if it's your permanent abode.
Right around the time he was thinking about leaving Genesis, Peter Gabriel got a call from the film director William Friedkin, who just made The Exorcist and The French Connection. Friedkin had read a surreal little story Gabriel had written for the back of an album cover, and he wanted to collaborate on movie ideas with the young rocker. Gabriel had always harbored a desire to be a filmmaker, so he jumped at the chance. Nothing really came to fruition from it, but Gabriel would, some years later, write songs for many films and soundtracks for Birdie, Rabbit Proof Fence, and The Last Temptation of Christ. When you listen to his soundtrack work, you realize that you can clearly hear some essential Peter Gabriel-ness, even without his voice. The atmosphere, the rhythms, the influence and input of world music, the simultaneous feeling of timelessness and modernity. Although fans usually think first and foremost of his voice and lyrics, Peter Gabriel said in this interview with Mary Jordan that as a songwriter, what always felt best to him was melody, harmony, and rhythm.
And sometimes the words will come easily, but for me, that's a sort of slower, more difficult to get past the censor, my internal censor. And having owned a studio now and watched many bands come in, you're often seeing a group of players sitting around what I would consider the poor, unfortunate vocalist who's struggling to squeeze a few words out. So trying to get something that you feel says means something to you and will mean something to other people is work. You know, I think talent is hugely overrated. I think most of it's hard work.
So of the success equation, what percent is hard work and what percent is talent?
The way I look at talent is, on any of the arts, is that they're just languages. In other words, if I was dropped in any country in the world and in order to survive had to learn some of the language, I would find a way to do it. Some people would be quicker and better and more adept than others, but everyone could do it. And I feel the same, you know, with writing music, with painting, or whatever creative form it is. If you really believe that that you'd swallowed a pill that would destroy you in 12 months' time if you hadn't proved talent in a certain area, you would be amazed at how much you could do and how good you could be. You know, and I think people, you know, we're creatures naturally, most of us, full of self-doubt, and you need to have that conviction that there's something worthwhile that you can do. And, you know, I think a lot of people I know who end up doing creative stuff are either they think they're a piece of shit, or they think the best thing in the world, you know, and possibly both at the same time. So it's to manage that sort of pathway so that you can actually keep on working hard is what you need to learn. Some people are going to get there faster, find it easier, and be more eloquent with it. But it should exclude no one, and everyone has their own voice and the possibility of doing some, as you know, let enthusiasm be your compass.
It's a message that was reinforced for him at the Academy of Achievement's London Summit in 2017. One of the beautiful things that happens at the Academy's summits is that honorees from wildly different disciplines are able to connect and commune. Peter Gabriel found himself sitting next to the renowned biologist, Sir John Gurdon, over dinner.
He told me when he was at school, of all the students in the school, of which there were 250, he was number 250 in science. And he found a teacher afterwards who inspired him and allowed him to think, actually, I can do this. And, you know, he's now got a Nobel Prize. And so that's what I say to young people now, is that don't let any obstacle or people discourage you from what you're passionate about. It should be like dogs going in the park, you know. You go in there with your tail wagging, you sniff anything interesting, and you jump on it.
Peter Gabriel is passionate about a lot of things and has jumped at it all. Songwriting and singing, of course, family life, but also opening doors for musicians from around the world and developing technology and campaigning for human rights. So if he had to describe his core talent?
I think I'm a hustler. You know, I'm trying to get things to happen and I work hard. I think probably it's that I have managed to fool myself into believing things are possible.
What did you learn about getting over the hurdles to make something happen?
It's that, you need to put yourself in the right place. You know, and one of the people I was talking to about this said in the Kabbalah there's a saying that if you get very sick, you change your name and change your address. And I thought, actually, that's quite smart because you're putting your mental framework in a different environment. And I think to get something done, you know, allow yourself to be this other thing. And, you know, the baggage and the what they call the imposter syndrome, that I'm not going to be able to do this, or all these people are saying this stuff about me and maybe they're right, and that allows you to shut that out and say, okay, doesn't matter, actually. You know, let's just give it a go and go for it. And that's really, I think, the main thing for young people is there's going to be plenty of doubt and naysayers. Trust. I have what I call my little voice, and it sometimes says things to me that are non-rational, and I try whenever I can to follow it.
Little voice is actually more helpful than the big voice?
Little voice, yeah, is intuitive and instinctive, and we, I think we all have that and tend to block it out very easily.
Is there anything you can do to kind of amplify the little voice?
Yeah. I've spent a lot of time, you know, thinking about how people function and what makes them feel good and keeps their health and so on, and one of the recommendations for people is think of everyone you know. Who makes you feel good and bigger? Who makes you feel bad and smaller? You know where to go, and you know who to exclude. That helps. It seems silly, but the same with, I think, a lot of our activities in life. You know, we need just to analyze, well, what's working for us? You know, where are we instinctively at ease, feeling we're going with the flow, and where are we feeling the opposite? And you just do more of the right stuff.
It's well said.
Which pretty much brings us back to the moment that Peter Gabriel listened to his little voice, telling him to leave his very successful rock band, Genesis, for a solo career. In case you need a refresher, I'm going to take 2 minutes here to play just a few of his biggest hits from the late 1970s and the 80s and the 90s.
Climbing up on Salisbury Hill, I could see the city light. Wind was blowing, time stood still. Eagle flew out of the night. Moved on to another town, tried hard to settle down. For every job, so many men, so many men no one needs.
Don't give up, 'cause you have friends.
Hey, we touch, this place is so quaint, sensing that storm. Frontiers, war without tears. Games without frontiers, war without tears.
I've noticed a glaring omission from my montage. I thought it just needed its own moment in the sun. I'm talking, of course, about In Your Eyes. It would be very hard for any interviewer to talk to Peter Gabriel about his life and work without coming around to asking the In Your Eyes question. And our interviewer, Mary Jordan, was no exception. What did Peter Gabriel think, she wanted to know, when he saw John Cusack, forgive me, Lloyd Dobler, blasting the song from a boombox held high over his head to woo back the girl in Say Anything? The scene is what made Say Anything the romantic teen classic that it is. And as I record these words, by the way, the movie is just days away from its 30th anniversary.
I had no idea it was going to become this sort of iconic thing. But I'm very grateful that it was chosen, because it was, it's one of the most parodied scenes in Hollywood.
It is indeed. There's such a great line.
And I still
line.
Get royalties on it, so I'm happy for that.
All my instincts, they return. The grand facade so soon will burn. Without a noise, without my pride, I
There's such a great line in it. I want to touch the light, the heat I see in your eyes. You know, the words there,
all
right?
Romantic. Yeah.
But light, heat, your eyes, these are the same words in a lot of love songs. What is it about the order or the melody behind it. Why do some of these love songs, like that one, last?
Well, you know, I was in love with a lot of African music around that time, and bits of it were written in Senegal. But one of the ideas that interested me in African music is that a love song could be, you know, a love for a woman or a love of God. And the two could be confused with no problem, that they could be about love. Whereas in our society, you know, spiritual was one side, sort of sexual and romantic was another. And so that fusion was what I was trying to explore lyrically, and in the music, there was definitely some African influence, and I think so it has a life to it that flows effortlessly. And then, you know, I was working with Yusu Ndour, who does this amazing singing. You know, it is this sort of angelic voice at the end. So I think a combination of those things helped it to work.
This song introduced Yusu Ndour to audiences outside of Africa. Inside Africa, he was already a superstar, perhaps the biggest of all time. Peter Gabriel didn't just use that mesmerizing voice on the song. He invited Ndour to tour with him when his mega hit album So came out in 1986. 2 years later, Yusu Ndour was one of the featured artists, along with Peter Gabriel and Bruce Springsteen and Sting and Tracy Chapman, on the Human Rights Now tour for Amnesty International. The Philadelphia stop on the tour, by the way, is the concert I referred to at the top, where I first saw Peter Gabriel live. It was one for the ages. Our interviewer, Mary Jordan, asked Gabriel how he made that turn from rock star to political rock star.
Well, I sort of fell into human rights, really. I didn't, you know, I came from a comfortable background, and then when I put my calling card in, I think, was when I wrote the song Biko. And, you know, I've been interested in what goes on in the world. And when Steve Biko was arrested, a lot of people thought that the publicity surrounding his arrest would be enough to protect him. So there was a sort of real sense of shock when we heard he was but he'd been murdered.
Stephen Biko was an activist in South Africa during apartheid and was leader of the Black Consciousness Movement. When he died at the hands of state security officers in 1977, 20,000 people attended his funeral. Peter Gabriel's song Biko came out 3 years later.
It became one of the most powerful anti-apartheid human rights songs ever recorded, and actually had pretty big political impact.
Well, no, I heard it got, you know, people would sing it in South Africa, and it was used in rallies and so on. So that and in stadiums. So that was, it was great to hear. And I mean, when we did the Human Rights Now tour, in fact, it was towards the end of the apartheid government, and there were interesting discussions. Whether we should go to South Africa or not, because we'd been asked by the anti-apartheid movement not to go. It was a cultural boycott. Yet Yusu Ndour and Tracy Chapman, the black artists who were with us, they thought, actually, no, this is part of a process that sort of opens things up and liberalizes. So we had those discussions, and we ended up... Bill Graham was there, you know, and he used to have these two planes, one full of gear and the other full of musicians and crew. And And occasionally when gigs were cancelled or people got scared of us, you know, we'd be there with a map of the world trying to where can we land our planes. It was quite unlike any other tour. A sort of life-changing experience for many of us because, you know, human rights means something you read about, see in the Guardian newspaper. But we hadn't really met many people around the world that had been tortured or lost loved ones, and suddenly there they were and they're talking to us. And it's very hard then at that point to walk away. And I found it very compelling, and I was also shocked that people could go through some of the experiences and then have their horrors totally denied, buried and forgotten. I think it was important. You know, the membership of Amnesty was doubled around the world as a result of that tour, and for all of us as musicians, I think it changed the way we saw our role. And
how did it change?
Well, made us convinced that actually, you know, you may not change the world, but you can have an impact. You can be part of a process that questions and proposes something different.
And you've said music is a universal language. It draws people together and proves, as well as anything, the stupidity of racism.
Yeah, well, we put together this festival, which is still going now. It was in 1980 we started work on it, and 82 was our first event. It's called WOMAD, World of Music, Arts and Dance. And a bunch of us had really started hearing what we thought were incredible artists from other countries around the world that were never going to get on our radio at that time. And there was maybe a couple of record stores where you could find their music in London. And so we thought, let's get an event together and bring a lot of people from around the world. La mucura está en el suelo y mamá no puedo. Me la llevo a la rodilla y mamá no puedo. Ay, es que no puedo. Ay, mamá no puedo.
Me la llevo. To extend the reach of these artists from around the globe, Peter Gabriel and the WOMAD Festival gave birth to a studio and a record label called Real World. If you go on their website, you'll see over 100 of their artists listed. Musicians from Africa, Asia, the Middle East, Europe, North America, South America, Oceania, the Caribbean, and the Indian subcontinent. Sometimes together on the same album.
I really worry right now that we've got this whole tide moving of politicians in many countries that are becoming elected, trading on fear and hate and division. And racism is underlying that, and this sort of the immigrant as the enemy, whereas, you know, there's very few countries that weren't built out of and by immigrants. You know, our history is always moving and flowing, and all this extremist, hate-filled, anti-them stuff is silencing our better nature, which I'm still convinced is there. I would like to see a young people, many of whom are still idealistic, as they always are, create some sort of movement. And, you know, the hippie movement was what happened when I was a kid, and I think we need young people to generate some sort of kickback to this extremist, populist monopoly of the media. Al calor de una cerveza voy bebiendo mi ciudad al compás de la noche observando a mi gente la pobreza de la raza.
You used to be so positive about the power of technology, and a mobile phone in the hands of a poor person could give him limitless knowledge. Are you as optimistic about the power of technology now?
100%. That the potential of technology. You know, I was at this XPRIZE dinner the other night, and they have projects now to use technology to feed 1 billion people, to get kids that can't read or write, reading and writing in any language within 18 months. I mean, we have a project we're trying to kickstart about streaming medical treatment, because when the digital revolution hits medicine, not just in diagnostics but in treatment, it's going to get access to people around the world in the same way that the phone gave people access to communication, to Wikipedia, to Google. You know, it's very powerful. But I think the people who I believe are working for themselves are using media much more effectively than people who are working for mankind.
Peter Gabriel, going back at least to 1989, was finding ways to use technology for good. That year, he founded an organization called Witness. Their slogan is, "See it, film it, change it." People often think it was inspired by the Rodney King incident, when a bystander videotaped Los Angeles police officers as they brutally beat Rodney King during an arrest. But the truth is, Peter Gabriel's organization, Witness, was already in the works before that day. It grew out of the Amnesty International Human Rights Now tour.
What was very clear is whenever someone had suffered a human rights abuse and they managed to get it on video, or they got their experience and they were telling their story on video, it was much tougher for those in power to bury that story. And, you know, people would respond emotionally to the video content. And so Reebok Human Rights Foundation, who had funded the Amnesty Tour, had this... I made a proposal there to try and bring in an entity either within their foundation or separate that would use video and technology and try and arm activists and people who found themselves in a human rights struggle with video. And eventually, it took a while, that was adopted. And now I think we have the same opportunity with data. There's an amazing group called Forensic Architecture. They have an amazingly detailed approach to data, but we are moving to the age when video can be faked much better.
Right, so what's next?
So I think it's data rich.
What does that mean?
Okay, so they would look at, for instance, they've got some work on bombs in Syria, and they've taken photos from everyone's camera around the town where the bomb was dropped and recreated a three-dimensional format of the cloud created by the bomb. They've also been able to identify the bomb and the manufacturer. So it's like forensic evidence in supreme detail, and they create a timeline. So it's basically like creating a three-dimensional version of a bad event. I mean, they don't get involved in the argument. They just present the evidence, and the evidence speaks for itself. This is the next generation of human rights campaigning.
So why do you spend time on this? You know, you can sit at a beautiful piano in your beautiful studio outside Bath in England.
Well, I think it's exciting. And, you know, my dad was an electrical engineer, inventor, and he came up with an Italian thing called Dala Program, which was sort of electronic democracy, home shopping, education on demand. But this was 1971, and access through the rotary dial of a telephone. So he was a little ahead of his time, but his mission was sort of empowering technology. So that is part of what presses my buttons, is when you see people that can use technology to great advantage.
There's one other significant project we have to at least touch on before we go that's been a labor of love for Peter Gabriel, and one of his proudest achievements. It's called The Elders. The idea grew out of conversations that Gabriel was having with his friend, the business magnate Richard Branson, about the desperate need for wisdom in world affairs.
And it seemed that there were individuals around the world that people respected at the same time as they're losing trust in governments, institutions, and politicians.
They came up with a list of elder statesmen and were trying to think of how they could possibly pull off getting such an illustrious but far-flung group to agree, get on the same page, and try moving the world a little closer toward peace, justice, and human rights.
We both concluded that Mandela had more of a sort of moral currency, having come out of 27 years of jail, trusted his enemy to be build the future with him, you know, after they'd killed and tortured many of his friends. That's a pretty big leap that most leaders are not capable of.
It was a huge long shot, but in 2001, they got their chance over lunch with the then president of South Africa.
We did our pitch, and Mandela was really not very impressed at the beginning. He said, I'm sure people in power don't want a bunch of old-timers interfering. But by the end of the meal, he said, there was this time when they asked me to intervene with Hutus and Tutsis who'd been sort of slaughtering each other in Rwanda. And the young generals on both sides said, actually, we're only gonna negotiate with you. Everyone else here has got an agenda. But with you, it's like talking to our dad, and we trust you. But you have no interest other than a good outcome for everyone. And so that was the sort of currency that persuaded him to take it on. But it still took another few years to get it, you know, because he was being hustled by every well-meaning person in the world who knew that the Mandela magic would sprinkle some fairy dust on whatever it was they were trying to do. So,
but he had met the hustler named Peter Gabriel.
No, well, and Richard's not a bad hustler either, I tell you. And and eventually, you know, he came around and we had this launch in 2007 in Joburg, in this former court building where, you know, a lot of his black colleagues have been sent to jail and so on. It was an amazing moment.
The Elders is now a full-fledged organization that tackles a range of pressing international issues. And the Elders themselves, there are 16 of them, come from almost as many corners of the world as the musicians on Peter Gabriel's Real World record label. One of the Elders, by the way, is former U.S. President Jimmy Carter, who will be the featured guest on the next episode of this podcast. But I digress a little. There are a lot of actors and writers and musicians who get involved in political causes and charities and find ways to give back. But it's hard to think of many artists who have so deeply and consistently used their stature and their influence to help others, as Peter Gabriel. A couple of years ago, the singer Taylor Swift told NPR that Peter Gabriel had a huge influence on her musically because his approach was so innovative and ahead of its time, and that he was, quote, remarkable at giving people what they want, but didn't think they wanted. The same could very well be said of his work to make the world a better place.
So you're only 68 years old as we sit here in this London hotel room not far from Notting Hill. And when you look back, you still have lots more to do, but when you look back, is there anything you would have done differently?
I think, you know, when you get reflective, you know, I always think of my deathbed, I'm not really going to care about anything to do with work. It's the people you love and treating them right. And I think I could have done some things better there. But I've had a really interesting life, and I've pushed myself to do things that go where I was afraid and what I was uncomfortable in, and I've always got a lot back from it. So I feel very grateful and very lucky in lots of ways.
That's Peter Gabriel. He was interviewed by Mary Jordan, who by day is a correspondent for The Washington Post. Peter Gabriel has a new album out later this week, April 13th, 2019. It's a collection of his songs from the movies called Rated PG. Get it? PG, Peter Gabriel. The one you're hearing is Down to Earth from the movie WALL-E.
Did you think you'd escaped from routine by changing the script and the scene? Despite all you made of it, you were always afraid of a change.
I'm Alice Winkler, and this is What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement.
You got a lot on your chest. Well, you can come as my guest, so come on down. Come on down. We're coming down to the ground. There's no better place to go. We got snow upon the mountains. We got rivers down the road. Hear the birds sing in the trees, and the land will be looked after. We'll send the seeds out in the breeze.
What It Takes is generously funded by the Catherine B. Reynolds Foundation. Thanks to them and to you for listening.
We felt at home in the sea. We learned to live off the good land. We learned to climb up a tree. Then we got up on two legs, but we wanted to fly. And when we messed up our homeland, we set sail for the sky. We're coming down to the ground. There's no better place to come. We got snow upon the mountains. We got rivers down below.